Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 30. Fakao Wanga Wanga. Flummoxed. Sherlock, John, Mycroft, and Erebus stand on the landing shore and they wait. They have been there for most of the day, scanning the waters for Seeger's arrival. They've told the others they are acting as an ad hoc welcoming committee, and no one disagrees that the colony's leader deserves to be greeted upon his arrival. In truth, they are waiting for Seeger so that they waste no time pulling him aside, confiding in him the matter at hand, and seeking his counsel. They do not want to wait for the evening after the excitement of seeing friends and family members has left them exhausted. They do not want to risk that other important business will arise and usurp their agenda, or that they won't catch a private moment with Seeger until tomorrow. They don't want to delay one more minute than they have to, because the pressure they've been under since Erebus realized exactly what it was Moringa stole has been building and building, and they need to share this, or they will collectively implode. While they wait, Mycroft and Erebus take turns examining the tooth. Neither seem over the shock of Sherlock and John's announcement, and are treating the tooth as if it might break, or yell at them, or transport them somewhere. Mycroft had been very angry when he realized Sherlock hadn't come to him the moment he found it, but Erebus had been Erebus, always constant, and had hugged both him and John, and told them how extraordinary they were. Sherlock suspects that Mycroft did not believe the star-edged artifact existed until Sherlock actually produced it. In fact, Mycroft's face, when Sherlock had let the tooth slide out from under his wing and come to rest on his other wingtip, will ever remain one of his most cherished memories. He and John have spent the entire morning trying to come up with the right word for that look.
"Astonished?" John suggests. "Yes, but more than that. Astonished with shades of disbelief, I think."
"Flabbergasted?" John tries again.
Sherlock presses his wings together under his bill and hums.
"Stupefied?"
"Dumbfounded!"
John shouts, wings up in a victory stance.
"Yes, John, exactly. Because my brilliance found him dumb."
"I don't think the word works that way, Sherlock."
Caught up in this amusing conversation about the precise term required to describe Mycroft's face, they do not realize the older pangs have joined them.
"I believe the word you are looking for, young sir, is Fakao Wunga Wunga," Erebus announces.
"Waka Wada, sir?"
Sherlock asks, leaning in and cocking his head. Mycroft sighs, but gestures that Erebus should continue his impromptu language lesson.
"Waka Wanga, Wanga," the elder repeats, drawing the word out so they can hear it, then saying it again, faster, so they can hear the inflection. "Flummoxed, bewildered, perplexed."
John immediately starts giggling. Sherlock, who had been focusing on hearing and memorizing this new addition to his already vast native vocabulary, looks over at John, and then he starts giggling too.
"Waka waka,"
they whisper into each other's necks, barely standing.
"Ah, yes, and there we have them, the young saviors of our modern world, falling about the place over a silly-sounding word."
Mycroft looks grim, but Sherlock can read him like one of Vela's seaweed leaves, the kind she uses to predict the weather or someone's love life or from which direction the seals might come. Mycroft may want Sherlock to think he's annoyed, but in truth, Mycroft is unsure, and if there is anything Mycroft cannot tolerate in himself, it is being unsure. He is particularly troubled because he has no real recommendation to make to their father. There is too little data and too many variables. The look on his face now, Sherlock thinks, is a cross between addled and afraid, and as much as Sherlock would like to revel in Mycroft's state of uncertainty, he finds he cannot do so. If Mycroft is Fakao Wanga Wanga, the situation is dire indeed. They continue to wait throughout the morning and then take turns hunting for lunch. Sherlock and John are just finishing a shared meal of silverfish and krill when Erebus, who ate first and has finished his post-meal preening, stands up straight, stares out into the swells, and says, "There."
"The first group is arriving."
The four emperors line up on the shore and watch the first migrators approach. Seeger leads the formation as they dive and resurface, using their time airborne to cover distance without expending the energy required underwater. They must be tired now, Sherlock thinks, having traveled for several days to return to Cassiopeia. He wonders for the first time if it's fair of them to burden Seeger with their celestial conundrum directly upon his return. As if reading his mind, Mycroft tilts his head toward Sherlock and says, "An emperor assumes tremendous responsibility when they become the leader of their colony. Ultimately, there is no action, no decision of significance that does not start or end with that individual. He would rather know immediately. Of this one fact, I am certain." Sherlock looks up at Mycroft and sees as clearly as he sees Mycroft's bill on his face that Mycroft will stand in Seeger's stead some day, and that he will be a very good leader, if a bit intimidating. Perhaps in time he will learn their father's ways of patience, humility, and warmth.
"He's here," Mycroft says, putting an end to Sherlock's distraction.
Sherlock looks up in time to see Seeger sail out of the water, clearing the edge of the landing shore in a high, graceful arc. One after the other, they come, leaping and sliding across the ice. It is a far different homecoming than the one that started their summer. Despite the growing crowd, Seeger has seen them and now makes his way to where they wait. Sherlock is sure that he has read them and the entire situation before he reaches them. There is a sharpness in Seeger's eyes, a stiffness to his spine and tail that speaks of an emperor bracing himself for the worst possible news. Next to him, John stands taller and pulls his shoulders back. Seeger bows to them, and they return the gesture. Wasting not another second on pleasantries, Seeger turns to Erebus, the most senior among them, and asks,
"What is it? What has happened?"
Sherlock loves Erebus, but thinks he will die if the Elder Pang takes as long to explain as Sherlock suspects he will. He watches Erebus take a deep breath, watches the worried expression on his face turn to one of storytelling. "Oh, there is no time for this," Sherlock thinks to himself. "No time at all for their stories and suggestions and suspicions." Stepping forward, out of line from the others, Sherlock looks up at his father and lets the tooth slide from where it is tucked against his body into the cupped tips of his wings. There is nothing but the sound of the wind whistling up and down Cassiopeia's frozen curves, and the sharp inhalation of Seeger's breath. Sherlock has seen enough of the tooth to last a lifetime, so now he watches his father bend down low and take a closer look. Just when he thinks perhaps his father does not understand, Seeger speaks.
"It cannot be."
Seeger raises his gaze from the tooth to his son's face, then lifts his wing and touches it to Sherlock's cheek. It is a gesture so unexpected, so tender, that for a moment Sherlock forgets why they're there.
"My dear boy, you have had quite a summer, haven't you?"
"Yes, Papa, John too."
"John too. Well then, I think it best that the two of you fill me in, and..."
He straightened up to include Erebus and Mycroft.
"Your brother and Elder Erebus as well."
It takes until dinner time for Sherlock and John to tell Seeger everything. They start at the beginning, filling in details for each other, one jumping in when the other must pause to take a breath. They explain how John had planned to use the ice cave as a viewpoint as he waited for Sherlock to arrive on that horrible, fateful day, and how, once John was recovered enough, they returned there frequently. They tell him about the treasures they carried there, so carefully chosen, and how John loved to decorate the cave with what they found. If Seeger understands more than they share, he does not let on. They explain, still indignant, how Moringa surprised them, and of her ridiculous accusation against them. They admit that they followed Huddy to her encounter with Moringa, and the confusing half-bits they overheard, and how Huddy agreed to accompany them back to the cave and what they found when they got there. They go over the morning Erebus overheard John and Sherlock telling the other junior Pengs in the creche what Moringa had taken, and the questions he asked them about the tooth. They say that Erebus then taught them Te Utomaika, and about Borangi going mad. They tell him about the meetings the four of them had, floating on floes for privacy, and they even tell him about John's idea to stab Moringa with icicles, and how hard they searched the iceberg, and how desperate they felt, counting down the days, unable to find Moringa's hiding place. John takes over to explain Lestrade's ice chip game and brags about Sherlock always winning the game and how they had to change the rules to make it harder for him. And when John tells the part about Sherlock finding the tooth wrapped in seaweed and tucked into a crack in Cassiopeia's hall, he is bursting with pride, adoration for his Ipo bright as day on his face. When Sherlock picks up the story again, it is to tell his father that he snuck away from the creche and spent the night trying to figure out where Moringa had been when she fell and what she had been doing there. He loses himself in the recalled images and descriptions of the ice cave and the realization that there was nothing there, nothing to find. He only pauses when he tells his father that no matter what the tooth may be able to do, he doesn't need it because he has John. And if he has John, he can do anything. He will not apologize for not telling Erebus and Mycroft sooner that he'd found the tooth, because his time alone with it led him to understand that he cannot choose a course of action by himself, not if he is to respect the colony and its deeply rooted teachings of community. He has learned so many things this summer, he ends, but the most important lesson is that Amarere is theirs to take, not theirs to wait for. Finally, completely drained, but with John at his side, he drops his head. That, Papa, is what happened.
That is no small adventure, Sherlock. You have both been beyond brave, beyond wise. Erebus, Mycroft, I owe you my most sincere gratitude for all you have done in my absence and for all that you are about to do. Erebus, fetch Pavo and Vela. Mycroft, fetch Cetus and Huddy. Sherlock and John, find Moringa. Tell her that she is to make herself available to me immediately. Stay with her. I will talk to her before the council meeting. Erebus, sound the call at sunset. We will start then.
Erebus and Mycroft are off like shots, each in a different direction, leaving John and Sherlock pressed side to side, bills hanging open.
Father, I...
Sherlock, my son, I know what you want to say, and I assure you it is not necessary. It is I who should apologize to you and John and the others for leaving you in the company of someone untrustworthy. I gave her the benefit of the doubt, and she was not ready. Perhaps it is not too late. Now go, so that we can start the work of our future.
Seeger turns. He cranes his neck up to the sky, his body elongating, his wings momentarily lifting. He shakes his head, feathers rippling and resettling from head to toe, and he nods just once and walks away.
What would happen now?
John whispers, watching their leader take his leave.
I've no idea.
Notes, Maori translations. Whakaa wanga wanga. Verb, to confuse, bewilder, perplex, flummox. Hui, conference, meeting, assembly. You have been listening to Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by C.W.B. and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past.